Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Welcome to Crimatorium, the place where crime lives. I'm your host, Madeline O'Brien. Today we explore a harrowing story that exposes the complexities of crime, punishment, and the human cost of justice. This is the case of Joseph Carl Shaw and James Terry Roach, two young men whose descent into violence led to devastating consequences for their victims, their families, and themselves. In this episode, we'll delve into the chilling events that unfolded in South Carolina, the tragic choices that sealed Shaw and Roach's fates, and the wider implications of their cases in the realm of capital punishment. In October 1977, the bustling yet close-knit community of Columbia, South Carolina, was shaken to its core by an unthinkable act of violence. Two teenagers, 17-year-old Tommy Taylor and 14-year-old Carlotta Hartness, were brutally murdered in a senseless and random attack. What began as a seemingly ordinary afternoon became one of the most horrifying events in the area's history. On that day, Tommy and Carlotta had been working on a school project about the town's historic district. Tommy and Carlotta were last seen near a baseball park, believed to be in or near the Wildwood neighborhood, which later became central to the investigation. Tommy had driven to the location in his car. Unbeknownst to them, their paths would cross with three individuals whose malicious intent would cut their lives tragically short. These individuals pulled up to Tommy's car and shot him at close range with a .22 caliber rifle. The men demanded money and Tommy complied. They removed the keys from the car, then turned their focus on Carlotta. They forced her into Shaw's car and drove her to a secluded road. There she was subjected to sexual assault by the men before being murdered. Witnesses later recalled hearing gunshots echoing through the area, a chilling prelude to the discovery of their bodies. The men then shot Tommy a second time, killing him. News of the murder spread rapidly, and residents were outraged and fearful. Law enforcement launched an intensive investigation, piecing together the evidence that would eventually lead them to the perpetrators, Joseph Carl Shaw and James Terry Roach, and a third accomplice, Ronald Mahaffey. As the details of the crime emerged, the horror deepened. It was later revealed that just days earlier, they had committed another heinous crime, the rape and murder of 21-year-old Betty Swank, a young wife and mother whose life was also stolen by their senseless rampage. The murders of Tommy Taylor and Carlotta Hartness became a defining moment for Columbia, a case that would not only bring their killers to justice, but also ignite a larger conversation about crime, punishment, and the devastating ripple effects of violence. Tommy Taylor and Carlotta Hartness were more than just names in a tragic story. They were vibrant, beloved teenagers with promising futures, whose lives were cruelly taken far too soon. At 17, Tommy was a thoughtful, driven young man with a passion for history. He was an active student at his local high school and loved learning about the past, so much so that he was helping to research his town's historic district as part of a school project. Tommy was described by friends and family as kind and respectful, someone who carried himself with quiet determination. He had an affinity for cars and often worked on them with his dad in their garage, a pastime that allowed them to bond over shared interests. Those who knew Tommy recall his gentle nature and the pride he took in his academic achievements, always eager to contribute to his community. At just 14 years old, Carlotta had already made a significant impression on those around her. A freshman in high school, she was known for her warm smile and an easygoing demeanor that made her well-loved by friends and teachers alike. Carlotta had recently celebrated her birthday and was just beginning to explore her passions, including music and art. She enjoyed spending time with her older sister and was deeply connected to her family. The youngest of three children, Carlotta also had an older brother who, like the rest of her family, was devastated by her untimely death. Carlotta's life was full of potential, and her family described her as a bright and loving girl with a kind heart. Tommy and Carlotta's lives intersected through their shared school project, and on the day of their murders, they were simply teenagers working on an assignment. Their loss was felt not only by their families, but also by their friends, classmates, and the broader Columbia community. Vigils and memorials were held in their honor, with community members struggling to comprehend the senselessness of such an act. The discovery of Tommy Taylor and Carlotta Hartness's bodies marked the start of a massive investigation that would stretch law enforcement resources to their limits. Tommy was found in his car, parked near the baseball field where the two had been working on their school project. Evidence at the scene revealed clear signs of violence. Shattered glass, personal belongings strewn across the interior, and blood evidence confirmed that the car had been a primary crime scene. Forensic teams meticulously combed the area, collecting fingerprints, fibers, and ballistic evidence in the hopes of reconstructing the events of that tragic night. Later that day, Carlotta's body was discovered by a passerby walking along a dirt road in a wooded area several miles from the baseball field. Her remains were partially concealed, and drag marks nearby suggested she had been moved. This secluded location, surrounded by dense trees, became a focal point for investigators gathering additional evidence. The condition of her body confirmed that she had suffered unimaginable violence before her death, further compounding the horror of the case. This wasn't a simple case of a single crime scene, but rather a chain of events involving multiple locations. Investigators knew that both sites presented critical evidence that could potentially connect the crimes and lead them to the perpetrators. In the absence of modern forensic tools like DNA analysis, detectives relied on traditional investigative methods. They canvassed the Wildwood neighborhood and the wooded site, speaking with anyone who would have seen or heard something unusual that night. Residents reported seeing an unfamiliar vehicle near the school, but the details were vague. This initial tip gave the police their first possible lead. The victims' families were interviewed extensively, though the questioning was conducted with great sensitivity, given their grief. Detectives hoped to understand the teenagers' routines and whether they might have crossed paths with someone dangerous in the days leading up to their deaths. Both families confirmed that Tommy and Carlotta were dedicated students with no known enemies. As the investigation progressed, law enforcement faced mounting pressure from the public. The brutality of the crime and its random nature created widespread panic, with parents becoming increasingly protective of their children. The idea that such a horrific act could occur in their community without immediate resolution was deeply unsettling. Authorities promised swift action, but behind the scenes, they knew this case would be anything but straightforward. The team's only hope lay in piecing together the evidence before the trail went cold. The case began to take shape when a local resident reported seeing a suspicious vehicle near the Wildwood neighborhood on the night of the murders. Described as an older model, light-colored car in poor condition, this vehicle matched earlier accounts from residents near the wooded dirt road where Carlotta's body was discovered. Police circulated the description, hoping for more information. The breakthrough came when a patrol officer spotted a vehicle matching the description parked outside a modest home in Columbia. The car was registered to Joseph Carl Shaw. Already known to police for minor offenses, quickly became a person of interest. Investigators connected him to the area on the night of the murders and began scrutinizing his recent activities. This led to his connection to another crime, the murder of Betty Swank, which shared disturbing similarities to the killings of Tommy and Carlotta. Betty had been murdered just 11 days before Tommy and Carlotta. On the night of her death, her car was intentionally disabled, forcing her to stop. She encountered Shaw and his accomplices, who abducted her, sexually assaulted her, and shot her fatally. Despite her injuries, Betty managed to run toward a nearby mobile home park, where she collapsed and died. Forensic analysis of Shaw's car revealed materials that matched evidence from Betty's crime scene. Additionally, police uncovered rumors from acquaintances that Shaw had boasted about committing crimes and getting away with it. Due to the overwhelming evidence in the Taylor Hartness case and the resources required for additional death penalty trials, prosecutors prioritized Tommy and Carlotta's case. Fifth Circuit solicitor James Anders offered life sentences in exchange for guilty pleas in Betty's murder. While this resolution brought some accountability, it left Betty's family questioning whether true justice had been served. With Joseph Carl Shaw, James Terry Roach, and Ronald Eugene Mahaffey in custody, the legal process moved swiftly. Prosecutors were determined to secure convictions for the brutal murders of Tommy Taylor and Carlotta Hartness. Shaw, Roach, and Mahaffey had spent the day of the murders drinking and using drugs, which investigators believed fueled their violent behavior. Shaw, the group's ringleader, had a known history of aggression and reportedly expressed fantasies of committing violent crimes in the past. Roach and Mahaffey, both younger and more impressionable, felt under Shaw's influence, joining him in what they later described as a thrill-seeking spree. The trio reportedly drove around Columbia with no specific plan, looking for victims to rob or assault. During the trial, Mahaffey testified that Shaw had talked openly about wanting to commit a murder, viewing it as a way to feel invincible. Roach admitted he had willingly participated, claiming he felt pressured to prove himself to Shaw. The trials began with overwhelming evidence against the defendants. Mahaffey's detailed confession proved to be the linchpin, providing investigators with a chilling account of the events on October 29, 1977, including the roles of Shaw and Roach. In exchange for his cooperation, Mahaffey accepted a plea deal which spared him the death penalty but resulted in a life sentence without parole. Shaw and Roach, however, faced the full weight of the charges against them. Prosecutors sought the death penalty, arguing that the calculated and heinous nature of the crimes warranted the ultimate punishment. They presented ballistic evidence linking the .22 caliber rifle used in the murders to Shaw. Additionally, forensic analysis found fibers and materials in Shaw's car that connected it to the crime scenes, leaving little doubt about the men's involvement. Shaw's defense team attempted to portray him as a man with a troubled past. However, his cold demeanor and lack of remorse during court proceedings worked against him. Witnesses testified that Shaw had shown no hesitation in planning and carrying out the murders, painting him as a calculating individual who manipulated his younger accomplices. Roach's defense focused on his age and intellectual limitations. At 17 years old at the time of the crime, Roach had an IQ of just 80 and a history of developmental struggles. His attorneys argued that he lacked the mental capacity to fully comprehend the consequences of his actions and had been heavily influenced by Shaw. Despite this argument, Roach's own confession, as well as Mahaffey's testimony, left no doubt about his involvement. The jury deliberated for just a few hours before delivering their verdicts. Both Shaw and Roach were found guilty of all charges, including murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault. During the sentencing phase, the prosecution emphasized the sheer brutality of the crimes, while the defense pleaded for leniency, particularly in Roach's case, citing his youth. In the end, the jury recommended the death penalty for both Shaw and Roach. The sentences were handed down swiftly, making Shaw and Roach among the first individuals in South Carolina to face execution under the state's reinstated death penalty statutes. The trial drew widespread media coverage not only for its gruesome details, but also for the ethical questions it raised. Could a juvenile offender like Roach, with documented intellectual disabilities, truly be held to the same standard as an adult? Did Shaw's military background and history of trauma mitigate his actions, or did they make him more dangerous? These questions lingered long after the verdicts were delivered, as the case moved through the appeals process and ultimately culminated in both men facing the death penalty. The convictions of Joseph Carl Shaw and James Terry Roach brought some relief to the grieving families of Tommy Taylor and Carlotta Hartness, as well as to a community still reeling from the senseless violence. However, the legal battles weren't over. Both Shaw and Roach launched appeals against their sentences, while the ethical and legal implications of their cases drew national attention. During his time on death row, Shaw granted an extended interview that offered a rare glimpse into the mind of a man who could commit such unthinkable acts. Reflecting on his crimes, Shaw described them as unnecessary and senseless, expressing profound regret. He stated, "There's no way I can bring the victims back, but all my sorrow goes out to the family." Shaw also acknowledged his struggles with drugs and alcohol, but made it clear he did not use them as an excuse for his actions. "Drugs and alcohol don't make you do what I did. That was all on me." In his final days, Shaw reconnected with his Catholic faith, claiming to find solace in prayer and repentance. On January 11th, 1985, in his final statement before his execution, Shaw expressed remorse, saying, "I have no bitterness toward anyone. May God bless and forgive you all." He also condemned the cycle of violence perpetuated by the death penalty, saying, "Killing was wrong when I did it, and it is wrong when you do it." His apology extended to the families of Tommy Taylor and Carlotta Hartness, as well as Betty Swank. Roach's execution followed nearly a year later, on January 10, 1986, and drew significant protests due to his youth and intellectual limitations. Mother Teresa and President Jimmy Carter petitioned for clemency, but despite these efforts, his sentence was carried out. In his final moments, Roach expressed remorse and left a poignant message. "I pray that my fate will someday save another kid that ends up on the wrong side of the tracks." Ronald Mahaffey, who had cooperated with authorities and avoided the death penalty, spent his remaining years in prison. During his incarceration, Mahaffey married Sandra Harrington, a woman 7 years his senior. The exact date of their marriage is unclear, but it occurred while he was serving his life sentence. Sandra, who passed away in 1998 at the age of 43, preceded Mahaffey in death by 2 years. Mahaffey himself died in 2000 at the age of 41. While his exact cause of death remains unclear, memorial contributions were directed to the Hepatitis Foundation International, hinting at a potential connection to the disease. His death added another unusual chapter to the aftermath of their horrific crimes. The profound grief of the Taylor and Harkness families was compounded by questions about whether the murders could have been prevented. This sense of frustration and helplessness led Tommy Taylor's father to pursue legal action against the federal government. At the time of the murders, Joseph Carl Shaw was serving as a private first class in the United States Army assigned to the 130th Military Police Company at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. In the wake of the murders, Tommy's father filed a lawsuit seeking $1.5 million in damages. The lawsuit alleged that Tommy had sought treatment for drug and psychological issues, but the lawsuit alleged that the government employees at Fort Jackson failed to provide appropriate care. The plaintiff argued that their negligence in failing to institutionalize Shaw or ensure proper treatment allowed him to remain free to commit crimes. The allegations raised systemic questions about institutional responsibility and whether red flags in Shaw's behavior had been ignored. However, the case was ultimately dismissed. The court ruled that the federal government was not liable for Shaw's actions because he was acting outside the scope of his military employment at the time of the murders. For the Taylor family, the lawsuit's dismissal was another painful blow. While it did not bring the justice they had hoped for, it highlighted missed opportunities to intervene in Shaw's destructive path, leaving lingering questions about systemic accountability. Carlotta's sister, Miss Harkness, shared deeply moving reflections about the impact of this tragedy on her family. Out of respect and to avoid mispronouncing her first name, since no reliable sources provide guidance on how it's pronounced, I will refer to her as Miss Harkness throughout this episode. The murder of 14-year-old Carlotta Harkness devastated her family in ways that extended far beyond the immediate tragedy. Carlotta's older sister, Miss Harkness, recalls that day in 1977 as the moment her family began to unravel under the weight of unrelenting grief. "I didn't just lose Carlotta that day," Miss Harkness said. "I lost my entire family." Their father instructed Miss Harkness and her brother never to speak Carlotta's name again, an attempt to shield himself from the pain, but one that only deepened the family's isolation. Their mother buried herself in gardening, working for hours each day to create a form of emotional distance. "The anguish was so great," Miss Harkness reflected. "It was like steel doors closing on a bank vault." Miss Harkness's own struggles with the tragedy were compounded by insensitivity from others. A therapist she turned to for help once asked her to sign a release allowing her family's story to be used in his master's thesis, a request so thoughtless it drove her away from therapy entirely. Decades later, in 2010, Miss Harkness discovered a painful artifact in her parents' bathroom, a piece of paper listing Carlotta's full name, her birth and death date, and the word "murdered." Her brother's information followed, with his date of death filled in. Then came her own name, her birth date written inside of it, with a space for her death date, ominously blank. "This is what people need to understand," Miss Harkness said. "You have all these people out there like us walking around trying to keep it together." Over 40 years after Carlotta's murder, Miss Harkness remains determined to speak out, not only to honor her sister, but also to support other families who have suffered similar tragedies. She envisions creating a space for survivors to share their experiences and help others understand how to approach grieving families with care. "Don't pretend the tragedy never happened," Miss Harkness advises. "But if you're going to say something, ask permission first to speak about the victim. Don't just barge in. There are good days and bad days." Miss Harkness also warns against platitudes like, "It was all part of God's plan," a phrase that she recalls hearing from a well-meaning stranger shortly after Carlotta's death. Instead, she encourages concrete acts of support, taking survivors to the grocery store, helping with simple chores, or just sitting with them in their grief. Carlotta's story and the enduring impact of her loss underscores the ripple effects of senseless violence. For her family, the pain has not lessened with time. Instead, it has evolved into a determination to ensure that Carlotta's memory and the memory of so many others lost to violence are never forgotten. If you'd like to read more about the profound impact of Carlotta's death on her family, you can find a link to the Columbia Stars interview with her sister in the show notes. Thank you for listening to Crimatorium, the place where crime lives. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a review. It really helps others discover the show. To support Crimatorium and gain access to ad-free episodes and exclusive content, consider joining me on Patreon. Your support means so much and helps keep the podcast going. Until next time, take care.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.